R. Scott Clark is our speaker. He's a professor of church history and hysterical theology, as I like to call it, but historical theology at Westminster Seminary in California. This morning he's going to be speaking on why was the Reformation necessary? It's a great title right there. And then at 10:30, how Luther became a Protestant. And so, once again, we're glad to have Dr. Clark here for our conference. So, thank you very much.
Good morning. How are you all? It's beautiful here. It was dark when I got here last night, so I didn't get to see much. It was I was just out a little bit from the hotel here, but it's beautiful. A couple of years ago, we were at Tombstone for a few days in the summer, so I like it out here. I feel at home out here. It feels like my kind of place. Nobody looks at me funny when I wear these shoes. These are. I was born in Kansas, and I was raised in Nebraska. And I learned to drive in a pasture, and I wore my great uncle's boots when I worked cattle one summer and put up fence. Learned how fast a steer can move if he really wants to get after you. You learn how fast you can climb a fence if you need to in oversized boots. I live in Escondido, California, and I teach at Westminster Seminary in California. But don't blame them for anything I'm about to say this morning. I am wholly responsible for everything I'm saying this morning. So the question this morning is, why was the Reformation necessary? And it was necessary for, three reasons we'll say this morning. And the first reason was the moral crisis. First reason was the moral. There was a moral crisis prior to the Reformation. When Luther did not leave what we think of as Germany very often. In fact, he only left once in his life. In 1510, he was an Augustinian monk, and he was the vicar for his order, which meant he was a regional manager, is what we would say in business. He was in charge of about 10 monasteries, and for some reason, I've never read why, but he had to go to Rome to meet with the would have been the general or the chapter for his order, the person in charge of the order, the boss, the CEO. And it was a long trip in the pre-modern world, right before mechanized transportation. If you have to walk, how many miles can you walk in a day? 20 on a, you know, if you really had to. You can walk 20 miles, and if you're riding on the back of a mule, you're probably about going to do about that. Nobody wants to sit on the back of a mule for more than 20 miles, probably. So it was a long trip from Saxony to Rome. And when he got to Rome, you have to understand. I was born in a smallish town, raised mostly in larger cities, but I know small towns, spent a lot of time in small towns. Mom's from a town of 700 people just south of Dodge City. And Luther came from a small town. Almost all the towns and cities that we call them cities, they weren't cities by our lights, right? Sierra Vista would be a great city in the pre-modern world. Right, there just weren't that many people living in cities. Most of the world most of life was rural. It was agricultural. It was in the process of changing in the early 16th century. So he was a small town boy and had never seen any kind of a city. And he was a naive sort of small town boy. And he went to Rome and he was absolutely shocked. Absolutely shocked at what he saw in the big city. There's some nice scenes. There are two Luther films. There's an old black and white film that has a sort of who's the great Swedish? There's a great Swedish filmmaker, Bergman. It has a very if you know film at all, it has a Bergman feel to it. It's very dark and sort of existential and overwrought. almost like a silent film in some ways. There's a more modern film, In Color. It came out in the 90s. It's not bad. It's people always, you know, they always play a little fast and loose with history. But you know, there's the demands of the film and the story. The scenes in Rome, I think, capture what Luther saw. One of the first things he saw was Pope Julius II riding into town on a horse, wearing battle armor and a sword on his side. Julius was engaged. The papacy was constantly competing with Florence for control of the peninsula. So the papacy was essentially a petty Italian duchy, right? So there's sort of local Italian politics and competition for land and resources. And Julius was actually out on the front fighting physically for land. And he, in fact, he was in battle so frequently that he was known to conduct mass in his battle armor with a sword on. So people sometimes, I don't know if you've ever heard of Calvin's doctrine of the twofold kingdom, but that's one of the reasons why Calvin talked about a twofold kingdom. That Christ rules everything, but he rules everything in two distinct spheres. A secular, what he used to call secular. We used to be able to use the word secular in an unembarrassed way. It simply meant that that area of life that was common to believers and non-believers. Right? There's a difference between secular and secularist. Right, the secularist says there's nothing but the common, there's no sacred whatsoever. And we used to talk about this, the secular and the sacred, that which is set apart to God. For example, when your pastor administers communion, the form that he reads or the language that he uses, usually when we administer communion, we usually talk about setting apart common elements for sacred use. Well, common is just another way of saying secular, right? Ordinary, routine. Doesn't mean dirty, doesn't mean corrupt, it just means not set apart for sacred use. Well, at any rate, Calvin distinguished between that the sacred and the secular, and Christ rules over these two spheres in distinct ways. And he called this the twofold kingdom, the duplex regimen, he says, in the Institutes. So at any rate, Luther sees the Holy Father, the vicar of Christ on the earth, the successor of St. Peter, right, the holiest man in all of Christendom, in all of the world, riding into, at least in the film, and it's reasonable, you know, to think that it could have happened, you know, that he saw, because it was something that Julius did. And you just see it for just a second on the screen. He sort of flashes by this great thundering, right, hooves and this retinue of soldiers led by a fella in the battle armor and that's Julius II, Christ's representative on the earth. And he also saw priests coming and going from brothels, right? I don't have to fill in the details, right? If you don't know what a brothel is, ask your mom or your grandma. Back home we used to call them cat houses, but you know what I mean. So he saw priests and monks who were supposed to be holy men of God set apart. He saw the sale of indulgences in Rome on a scale and in a way that he had not seen in Germany. He was absolutely shocked. And so he had kind of a spiritual crisis while he was in Rome, because he went to Rome thinking he's going to the city of God that had descended out of heaven onto the earth, this shining city on a hill. And what he found was sin and corruption and depravity. Venality on a scale that he'd never seen before. And so the story goes, you know, he went to the Santa Scala, the Holy Steps, at the Vatican, or either might be the Lateran, St. John Lateran, or the Vatican. I don't know with certainty which. But anyway, he goes up the Santa Scala, the Holy Steps, and he's supposed to say the Our Father on the way up as part of a penance and to release his grandfather from purgatory. And he did, on his knees, every step, Our Father who art in heaven, another step, Our Father who art in heaven. When he got to the top, he is said to have doubted and said, who knows if it's true. He was shaken a little bit by this. So Luther himself experienced the effect of 1,000 years, most of 1,000 years, of saying within the Western Church that you're justified to the degree you are sanctified. This is something you absolutely have to understand. For most of 1,000 years, the church had gradually concluded that this is how the world works. God can only say of you, righteous, if you are actually inherently, intrinsically righteous. The reason for this is the short answer to answer that question. Why? The reason is, in short, that the church came to be influenced by a set of philosophical ideas that very closely related things to the names. And so, in other words, if you're going to call somebody righteous, they have to be inherently, intrinsically righteous. Inherently, actually, in yourself. Right? So you need to stay with me here. This is going to be this could be a challenge. In what you have to actually be what the word designates, righteous. Actually. Not potentially, not partially, but actually. Which meant that nobody in this life, it came to be said. Now this isn't dogma, this is the other interesting thing. It's not dogma, but this is a widely held belief. That nobody in this life is ever actually justified. Nobody in this life is ever actually justified. You were justified momentarily in your baptism, but then you sinned. And so the church very graciously instituted 7 sacraments by the 13th century. And by the way, we're going to come back to this, but the reason the church was able to institute 7 sacraments is the church adopted popular practices, things that the people liked. They were called sacramentals. Practices that the people liked, that meant something, that were significant to the people, and they gradually ratified those and turned those popular practices into sacraments. So be very careful what you do now, because what you do now in 300 years could be a sacrament. This is why we confess what we do in the Westminster Confession about the nature of worship and the rule by which we organize our life in the church and worship, so that popular practices, and think of all the right, those of you who are, you know, I'm over 50, so those of you who are my age or around my age, a little older, think back to the way worship was, right? Now I know it's orderly here, but just think back 30 or 40 years ago how worship was, and then how it is now, how rapidly things have changed. 40 years ago, did you see a drum kit in any church ever, anywhere? Now it's rare when I'm on the road, particularly in the summer, you know, drum kits, right? And so I have students who come to me who have never sung Psalm 23. They don't even know that people sing the Psalms. Right? God bless you. I see you have the Trinity Psalter, right? Hang on to that thing for dear life, because somebody's going to want to come and rip it out of your hands. So at any rate, the church had set up the system whereby you're justified because you're sanctified. You're justified to the degree that you're sanctified. So nobody's ever actually justified. Nobody's ever actually justified. So the church set up the system of 7 sacraments to enable you to become sanctified. The church was like a filling station, and you're like an automobile. And so you receive grace on Sunday at communion, and then through the week you sort of burn that off. And they thought of grace as a kind of medicinal substance. So in the medieval church, grace equals medicine. And they actually talked about it this way. Right? Grace equals medicine. And the sacraments are like medicine. And you get infused. You get a shot of grace. And you cooperate with that grace as best you can if you're really devout and pious. But you sin and you don't do all your penances. And so you're not really able to turn away the wrath of God against yourself. See, you're in this process now of you actually turning away the wrath of God. You, yourself, freely cooperating with grace, exercising your free choice and to cooperate with grace toward eventual acceptance with God, maybe, but nobody in this life. So doubt in the medieval church becomes of the essence of faith. And the whole purpose of this whole system really was to get you to be good. But it didn't work. And that's what Luther found out by the time when he got to Rome. If it was going to work in any place, it would work in, you'd see it in Rome, right? I mean, you have the Holy Father, you have the fount of grace right here, the mediator of God on the earth, the head of the church on the earth. And if there's any place, and you have the papal curia, you have cardinals, you have holy monks, then surely if it's going to happen anywhere, it's going to happen here. Of course, you know, it's not going to happen in our poor little villages with our ignorant people and our ignorant priests. But in Rome, it must happen, but it hadn't happened. And in fact, it hadn't happened anywhere. Rome was not unique. The church was profoundly corrupt, and it was corrupt from the in head and members. Sixtus the Fourth, who was a pope, extended. You remember I talked to you last night about indulgences, right? An indulgence was a payment that relieved your obligation to go through purgatory. An indulgence was a payment that enabled, right? You. And by the way, Rome still sells indulgences unashamedly. You go to heidelblog.net, just search for indulgences. I've described contemporary cases. In 2000, there was a jubilee. Rome declared a jubilee, and all you had to do was come to Rome and walk through an arch, and you got a plenary indulgence. I don't know how much it cost to walk through the arch, but you go to Rome and walk through the arch, you got a plenary indulgence. People have been, Rome still sells indulgences. You might have assumed that after 1517, she would have said, well, this is kind of embarrassing. We should probably shut this down. Rome is not embarrassed. She's never embarrassed because she's never wrong. Whatever she, in other words, after the fact, well, whatever we did, that must have been right. We're never wrong. It's great. Wouldn't you like to live that way? Well, officer, yes, I ran a red light, but I did it, so it must be right. That's Rome's attitude. Have your kids ever tried that with you? No, that was wrong. Come here. So Sixtus the Fourth, right? So Unigenitus had, in Unigenitus, the Clement the Sixth had issued indulgences, and Sixtus the Fourth in the 15th century had extended plenary indulgences now for the dead. So Sixtus the Fourth said, not only can you earn indulgences for yourself or buy indulgences for yourself, you can buy indulgences for your deceased loved ones. Well, we were trying to build the Vatican, and we needed money, and this was a great source. And besides, the archbishop got a cut, right? When there's money flowing, everybody wants a piece of it, right? And people were getting a piece of this along the way as it went to Rome. Innocent the Eighth in 1492, right? Those of you who got an education back when we were still teaching people in public school, remember? 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Yeah, see, they used to do history. You laugh. I teach graduate students. I have students who could not tell you that. They're you know, with no criticism. It's not their fault. The system has totally collapsed. It's a disaster. So anyway, and I because I get them on the final end of the process. Anyway, yeah, don't get me started. Innocent the Eighth, who flourished and was in office around 1492, fathered 16 illegitimate sons, but of which he admitted 8. Why is that odd? You think, well, what's wrong with a man having sons? Well. I don't agree with this, but it had long been the practice for priests to abstain from marriage, and so Sixtus was not married, so he was a serial fornicator, and he admitted to having fornicated at least 8 times. This was the Pope, right? And it gets worse. Alexander VI, otherwise known as Rodrigo de Borgia, died in 1503, openly kept a mistress in the Vatican. Right? He's a Roman king.
He was the son of the Pope as well.
He may have been the son. Yeah. Again, more fornication. He tried to make his son, right? He had a son, so I know that for certain. Cesare. Right, or Cesare de Borgia, he tried to make him a cardinal, Right? And so a cardinal is a, you know, we're having a civil election, or an uncivil election as it may be. we're having an election, and we have in the United States the wonderful institution, which will doubtless abolish, called the Electoral College, which prevents the unwashed masses from actually picking a president, which is the intent of the founding fathers. And the medieval church set up the very same process of electoral, basically an electoral college for picking popes. That's what a cardinal was. Cardinal was a papal elector, and he tried to make him a papal elector. I mean, he's trying to set up essentially a dynasty, right? It's like, have you ever seen The Godfather? One of the great, there were a lot of bad films in the 70s, but The Godfather is a great film. It's brutal, but if you want to understand the papacy, and in a sense, ancient life was built around the pater familias, who is essentially the head of the family, and he's the godfather. Right? I knew a couple of these guys. All right, everything, are you going to take care of them? We'll be all right. All right? It should be a shame if something bad should happen to your church. Right? These guys are real, actually. I lived, a little town I lived in north of Kansas City when I was pastoring there was run by the mafia. A little town called Gladstone, it was run by the mafia, and the mafia leader, the head of the mafia, the Kansas City mob, lived actually just a little ways from us, and nobody in my town locked their doors because there was no crime. Because nobody came into Gladstone because nobody wanted to get crosswise. They whacked a guy about six blocks east of me, about 2 a.m, he testified against them at trial, and they put 2 in the back of his head, and they left his body in the front yard as a scandal, as a way to shame his family. Normally, those guys disappeared. The old mob had the cement business in Kansas City. If you ever fly over Kansas City, you see a lot of cement in odd places. It's like, why is that some? Don't ask. You don't want to know what's in there. We used to see these guys come into the barbecue joint. They had their own room. They come in at 8 o'clock at night. It's 95, you know, 98 degrees, 100% humidity. They have long black coats on, dark glasses, hats. Right? Anyway. So these guys, this stuff is actually real. It's not just in the movies. And it existed in the Middle Ages, and Alexander VI was one of these guys. And the only reason that Cesare did not become pope, or did not become cardinal, and then eventually pope, was that he died of syphilis. And if you don't know how that happens, then again, talk to your mom. She'll tell you. And I already mentioned to you Julius II. So the church was profoundly corrupt in the high and late Middle Ages and even before. So justification through sanctification didn't work. We had vacant pastorates, vacant episcopal sees, that is, bishops' seats. We had princes serving as bishops and collecting salaries for both jobs. The church was a mess. It was profoundly, deeply corrupt. Yeah. Second reason why we needed a reformation was the crisis in authority. There was an authority crisis in the medieval church, beginning with, or at least symbolized by, maybe is a better way to put it, the Avignon, the crisis of the Avignon papacy. For like, right, you know, filet mignon. Which my English, I had an English friend who used to say filet mignon. He hated the French so much he refused to say filet mignon. So he knew how to say it, he just hated the French and he wouldn't say it. He insisted on butchering their language. The Avignon crisis, the crisis really lasts from 1378 until 1417 or so. And what happened in the Avignon crisis, in 1305, so it really goes back to 1305, Clement V moved the papacy from Rome to Avignon. And he moved it there in order to try to persuade the French to support the Crusades, right? And that gets us into a long story that I won't tell you. But the short version of it is the kind of things that we see out of Islamist terrorists today are not new. People who tell you, including presidents and others, that Islam is a religion of peace have never read the slightest bit of medieval history. Islam began as a violent movement. It succeeded as a violent movement. It only became pacified for basically political, military reasons. It was pacified by the European powers, even though Islamists reached the gates of Vienna in the 16th century. It was the expansion of European powers into the colonial expansion that really subdued Islam for a couple of hundred years, and it began to reassert itself. It began to prepare for a reassertion already in the 19th century. The Wahhabis started preparing for this a long time ago. They're like the Chinese. They're like the Chinese, and particularly the Chinese communists. They take the long view, right? And unlike we think it should be gone. And so with the collapse of the European powers, colonial powers, and the rise of oil money, we're back to where we were, essentially, in the rise of the Wahhabists, we're back to where we were before the expansion, colonial expansion. In other words, where we are now, and again, I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but this is why I get paid the big bucks. Or they keep telling me that it's big bucks. I don't know. We're back to where we were, and we're back to where we were for about 1,000 years. So this is not going away. People tell you this is going away, and we can fix this, and we can convince them that we mean them no harm, and they'll love us. That's just crazy talk. It's crazy. Well, the word Islam means submission. And they intend to make you submit. Now, it's not true of everyone everywhere. There are lots of liberal Muslims who don't actually believe what the Quran says, and they don't believe what the Hadith, Ahadith says, in English, the Hadiths. They don't actually believe that stuff. There are lots of liberal Christians too. But that's like saying the World Council of Churches represents authentic Christianity. Or the National Council of Churches, or the United Churches of Christ, or the PCUSA. Or the UCC, or what are they? UMC, which is a little better, but you get the point. The Episcopal Church USA, is that represents authentic historic Christianity? No, it doesn't. These people don't actually believe what we always believed. So that's true. So at any rate, the Crusades were, in my view, and in the view of others, it's a minority view, I think it's a reasonable view, a response to Islamist aggression. Now, not necessarily a good response, and not necessarily a response that I would endorse or support, but that's what happened. And anyway, he was trying to raise money. It costs money to go to war, as you know. And he moves the papacy to Avignon to gain support. In fact, there was some attempt in the period before 1378 to move the papacy back to Rome, but it failed. But in 1378, Urban VI was elected pope in Rome, and the papal electors soon realized that they had made a serious mistake, because Urban VI said, "You people are corrupt, and I'm going to clean this joint up." And they said, "Well, this guy's crazy.
We didn't elect him to clean things up." Right.
Again, think of the mafia. It's very much like the right. If you want to understand the papacy, watch The Godfather.
There's no way we gotta take care of this guy.
And so they went back to papal electors, went back to Avignon, and they elected another pope. Right, a guy from Geneva, Robert. I can't think of his name, but anyway, he becomes Clement VII, Robert of Geneva, I think. Is his name? I might be missing part of it. In fact, they're very proud of him in Geneva that they've had a pope. Not every town has a pope, And so now in 1378, you have two popes, Urban VI and Clement VII. Both of them, by the way, duly elected by those who had authority to elect a pope. It's like the Electoral College said, "Oops, we made a mistake," and then they elected another president. You had dueling presidents. Only these presidents, as it were, had the power, according to Rome to, according to canon law, to excommunicate people. Right. And so now they're excommunicating the followers. And you have this, it goes on, there are successors to these popes. If you go and you search, you know how to do it. Here, I'm going to teach you something that you might not know. This might actually be worth the price of admission this morning. Go, there's two ways to do this. This is a way to search, to use Google to find what you want on any website. Right? It's called a Google site search. A couple of ways to do it. The old way to do it, and the way I do it, because I think it works better, is to type in S-I-T-E colon. So then, and any website you want to search, so we'll say R. Scott Clark dot O-R-G. And then leave a space here, and then type in your search term. And so we'll just type in Avignon. If you do that, you'll find a chart where I've listed out all the popes that were in Avignon and all the popes that were in Rome. And you can see all of the successors. This is a Google site search, but you can do this with any domain, right? Anything you want to search, it will turn up, this Google site search. It's amazing. I'm also, my students tell me that all you have to do is just type in, like, whatever domain you want to do, R. Scott Clark, clark.org. And then put a colon there and you can do the same thing. So that's what they tell me. I've tried it and seems to me like I don't get the same search results. But anyway, that's a Google site search. I do that about 20 or 30 times a day when I'm working, because that's the best way to find stuff. At any rate, so if you, and my website, this of my websites is not that easy to use, so that's why site search is so helpful. The Heidelblog is a lot more well organized, so you can find stuff there. At any rate, so you can see for yourself all the different fellows who were popes, both in Avignon and in Rome. And Rome declares now that the popes who are in Rome are the true popes, and the popes who are in Avignon are anti-popes, they call them, A-N-T-I, popes. But again, if you ask them, well, on what grounds are they anti-popes? Well, because we say so. Right. Well, why do you say so? Because we say so. Yeah, but on what ground do you say so? Well, because we say so. So that's why I say the technical answer is hamana, hamana, hamana. If you're not already persuaded of the authority of the Roman communion to do that, then you certainly won't be persuaded. It's not a reasonable answer. Finally, in 1409, Alexander V was elected at the Council of Pisa. So now you have one in Avignon, right? You have one in Rome. And in 1409, there is a pope in Pisa. This time not elected by papal electors, but elected by a council. Now you have three popes, and all three popes excommunicating the followers of, and everybody sort of lined up, right? One said, I'm of Avignon. One said, I'm of Rome. And one said, I'm of Pisa. Does that sound familiar at all? Yeah, and so there, everybody is excommunicated. And finally, at the Council of Constance, John the 23rd, Pope John the 23rd, was actually imprisoned. Council of Constance in the 1417. At the Council of Constance in 1417, John the 23rd was put in prison. but then after he was released from prison, he was made a cardinal. I'm telling you, the mafia is the only way to, if you really want to understand Rome, by the way, if you want to see the primary documents for a lot of this, you want to see, for example, the Catechism of the Roman Catholic Church, you can see it. You know you're powerful when you have your own, national domain. The Vatican actually has a website, vatican.va. So you can search the Vatican website, right, just the way, and you can see the Catechism of the Roman Church. I'm not encouraging you to believe any of it, but you can see it for yourself if you want to see the documentation for some of this. And then he's imprisoned, and he's, as I say, he's made a cardinal. I was trying to remember last night which Benedict it was. It was Benedict the 13th. He was deposed, and Gregory the 12th abdicated. And they elected, and again, Constance elected Martin V as Pope. Well, what's the effect of this? Well, there are a couple of effects. If you're paying attention at all to what's going on in the world, and you have three popes, each of them claiming to be the vicar of Christ on the earth, duly appointed and elected with the authority of Christ, representing Christ on the earth, with the authority to speak, right, when he speaks from the throne, ex cathedra, right, from the throne, to speak infallibly. People often misconstrue papal infallibility. It's a silly doctrine, but we should articulate it correctly. Right? I saw a guy, somebody famous, I don't remember who it was, on Twitter this morning making fun of papal infallibility because they tweeted out, they published a tweet. The Pope isn't tweeting, but somebody in the Vatican published a tweet that had an English misspelling. And somebody said, so much for papal infallibility. Right? Which was cute. But that's the papal infallibility only it means that whenever the Pope speaks officially from the throne, ex cathedra, that's infallible and it's obligatory on all Christians. And they've only done it once, actually, at least in modern times, and that's the assumption of the BVM. So according to Rome, sometime in the 1950s, that's when this decree was issued, Mary is said to be now co-mediatrix. Or actually, technically, mediatrix and redemptrix. Redemptrix and mediatrix. The church had never actually confessed that way. And the only way you'd ever get such a doctrine promulgated is through a papal decree, ex cathedra. So near as I can tell, it hasn't been that ex cathedra authority has not been exercised very often, but it is a potential, and they were already talking about papal infallibility in the medieval period and in the 16th century. So it certainly calls into question the possibility of the Pope defecting from the faith. If a man is not actually Christ's vicar and he claims to be Christ's vicar, or he isn't, or he's been appointed, or the church appoints him as Christ's vicar, and he's not Christ's vicar, and he's been declared by another man who's been elected by electors, right? How do we know who's the true pope? Where's the true church? How do we know? It's a shell game, right? And if you're a loyal Romanist, and again, imagine if you're a loyal Romanist, and you've grown up in this system, this is all you've ever known. And if you're a serious Romanist, you go to Mass every day. You go to Mass, because Mass is being offered continually, right? They're making a memorial sacrifice of Christ's body, a memorial propitiatory, this is their language. They believe that when, you know, in the Eucharistic sacrifice after Christ, after the elements have been transubstantiated, transformed into the literal, actual body of Christ, that it is offered on the altar, and when it is offered, it is a memorial, but propitiatory, that is a wrath-turning away sacrifice. Right? That's why I used to, I don't say this to my students anymore, because it upsets them, but I used to say that, you know, listen, every so often somebody will have a crisis and they'll become a Roman Catholic, not because it makes any sense or it's true or has any relationship to history, but it satisfies an emotional, psychological need for certainty or what have you. They feel more accepted. And so I say, look, if you're going to do that, you at least ought to know what you're doing and what you're getting into. And you better get to work, because purgatory is a long, long time. And you've got a lot of work to get yourself utterly and perfectly sanctified in order to be accepted by God. So you better get your rear end out of bed and go to Mass every day. Your eternal welfare depends on not only on your attending to Mass every day, but on your performing all of the penances. And you better. So I mean, if you're, I don't know if you've ever known a really serious Roman Catholic. Well, imagine growing up in that system, and this is what you know. And all of a sudden, it's all thrown up in the air. Kind of like, if you remember 1968, a lot of things got thrown up in the air in 1968. And of course, with the Obergefell, I don't know, I've heard about six different pronunciations, Obergefell, Obergefell decision of the Supreme Court, right? Never in the history of humanity has a government declared that that people of the same sex constitute a marriage. It's never been done before, right? We're in the midst of a crisis that is perhaps the greatest crisis we've had culturally, socially, in the history of the United States. So we're in the middle of a similar kind of turmoil, and you wonder why our kids are confused. We can't even figure out who's a boy and who's a girl anymore. We've so disconnected the name from the thing that we don't even, we've lost our minds. I hope that people are going to look back, you know, 50 years from now and say, those people were insane. I hope. I'm afraid they won't. I'm afraid it's just a starting point. Anyway, it's a long story to how we got here, but I'm trying to help you understand the kind of crisis that this provoked. And so there had been doubts raised. So there had been doubts raised about this, or questions raised about this. And so there was also, about the same time, a little bit before, during, and then a little bit after, a reaction that said, you know, there's two L's or one. I don't want to put one. You're smart, is it? Are there two L's or one in conciliar? He doesn't know either. All right, good. We'll leave it one. If it turns out it's wrong, I'm sorry. Going back to the 13th century, for example, there was a fellow named Hugh of Pisa who had written about this. In the early 14th century, John of Paris actually argued that the Pope may be deposed by cardinals, by papal electors. And the concern was, what happens if a pope goes bad? And what's interesting is that wasn't very long after that, in effect, at least one of the three popes, one of the two and then one of the three, actually did go bad. And what happens? And so they said, well, you know, the authority of the church doesn't rest in the papacy. It rests in councils. And what's interesting is that at the very same time the church is arguing about this, the lawyers are arguing about civil life as well. Because everybody thought that authority starts from God and it flows through in the church, through the pope to the council, or through the council to the pope. And in civil life, we're having the very same argument. Authority starts from God, and does it go through the king to parliament, or from parliament, or from God to parliament to king? So there was an authority crisis in the 14th century, in the 13th century, 14th century, and 15th century, and one of the reactions was the conciliar movement, which argued that that authority rests in the council, not in the pope. And again, if you're paying attention, and eventually this filters down to you, and it wouldn't filter down to everybody, right? You're typically in the Middle Ages, life began like this. You were born to an illiterate set of parents who had a very short lifespan. You were fortunate to survive birth, and you spent your life shoveling manure in the streets, human manure in the streets, not just animal manure. If you've ever seen the opening to what's the Mel Gibson film about the Scottish Middle Ages?
History of the World.
Braveheart. The opening scene, and I think that's Edinburgh. Right? There's mud everywhere. It's just filthy. That's the Middle Ages right there. It's a great scene of the Middle Ages. Just disease, death, life was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Right? That was Thomas Hobbes' maxim about life without the great Leviathan to keep us all in order. But life really was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short in the Middle Ages. For most people, most of the time. And most people were illiterate. Couldn't read, never would read, and only heard about the possibility of an education. Most of the priests were illiterate. They had no idea what they were saying, if they could even remember the Mass. They were repeating in Latin stuff that they didn't even understand. And this is the guy you're going to for spiritual care? He's an illiterate knucklehead. Maybe he's a nice guy, but he doesn't know anything. He can't read his Bible. And there might not even be a Bible in your village. And if there is a Bible in your village, it's chained, right? Chained somewhere. But there might not even be a Bible in your village. Can you imagine that? How many people have Bibles on your smartphones? I have like 25 Bibles on my phone. It's phenomenal. We should not take that for granted. You can read, by the way, and treasure that, and make sure your children and grandchildren can read, because your teachers aren't going to do it. And I'm sorry if you're a public school teacher. I know it's not all your fault, but the system stinks. We're responsible for what happens to our children and our grandchildren. Your grandchildren can't read. Grandma, grandpa, you teach them to read. You know, you remember. I'm serious about this. Go break out McGuffey's Reader and you teach him phonics. We're right on the, I'm dead serious when I tell, I used to joke about the coming dark ages. I'm not joking about it anymore. We are on the verge of a coming dark ages. And it's, I tell my students, you are the last best hope for mankind. I said, you learn your Hebrew and your Greek. I'm not kidding. Because someday the power's going to go out and all your computers, and they're not going to work anymore. Right? It could go, you know, and things get ugly, and you better be able to do your Hebrew and Greek by candlelight. If you can't do it without your computer, if you don't really know your Hebrew and Greek, we're going to lose it. It only takes 100 years to lose Hebrew and Greek. I met the guy who basically saved Greek for the English evangelicals. One guy wrote a grammar, and he and the English evangelicals learned Greek again in the 1930s and 40s, 50s. John Wenham. He made some mistakes, theological mistakes, but he was a good man. He loved the Lord. He loved the Word. Absolutely devoted to inerrancy. And he was devoted to keeping the knowledge of Greek and Hebrew, but in his case, Greek, alive. So that we could obey what the Westminster Confession says, that controversies in religion are resolved by appeal to the original languages. So, at any rate, there was a great crisis of authority, and it only intensified, really, when William of Ockham said that the Pope, John the 22nd, was Antichrist. When we call the Pope Antichrist, if we ever do anymore, we don't want to hurt Francis's feelings. He's such a nice guy. How could he be Antichrist? We're just imitating William of Ockham, who was a medieval theologian who taught in Oxford and in other places. Marsilio of Padua in 1324 said, you know what? Authority doesn't rest in the council or in the pope. It rests in the king, and the king confers authority. So there's an authority crisis. And by the middle of the 14th century, right, the intellectuals in Europe are not entirely sure. They all know authority comes from God, but after that, it's an open question. But do you know where nobody is locating authority? Almost nobody is locating authority? Sacred Scripture. Now, Wycliffe is going to locate authority in Sacred Scripture. So Wycliffe actually anticipates some aspects of, not every aspect, but some aspects of the Reformation by locating authority in Sacred Scripture. Now, the last crisis is the one on which I wanted to spend the most time, but like always, I talk too much at the front end, is the spiritual crisis. But you can sort of begin to deduce where we're going here. We've already sort of started working on this. The spiritual crisis. Right? What's your spiritual life if you can't possibly be justified? What if you can't possibly ordinarily be justified in this life apart from a special work of grace, a miracle? What kind of assurance do you have? You can't have assurance. Doubt becomes of the essence of faith. The medieval church said repeatedly, and Rome canonized, right, as dogma for the Roman communion. Anyone who says that they know, I'm paraphrasing, but I have the quotation here. Session 6, 1547, Council of Trent, this is binding dogma, binding Roman dogma, right, immovable, incorrigible, cannot be changed, even though they contradict each other, cannot be changed. Anyone who says that they know that they are right with God, let him be anathema. I always feel like saying that like John at JFK. Let them come to Berlin. It's a historian's joke. When he was standing, there was the great historic movement. It's very, you know, the Cold War is on the verge of becoming a hot war. And there he is, and he says, Ich bin ein Berliner. What he said, right, what he meant to say is, I am a Berliner. It's sort of like after 9/11, you know, everyone said, we're all New Yorkers, we're all Americans, you know, even the French. We're all Americans, we're all New Yorkers. What in colloquial German, what Kennedy said is, I am a jelly donut. He didn't mean to say that. He shouldn't have said Ein Berliner. He should have just said Berliner. Ich bin Berliner. But he said Ein Berliner. And So if you listen very carefully, Alistair Cook pointed this out decades ago. You listen very carefully to the recording, you can hear some people chuckling because they knew he didn't mean to say that I am a jelly donut. Ask not what your country can do for you. Or tell me where I can find a jelly donut. There was a spiritual crisis, obviously, then in the Middle Ages, part of which was fostered by the corruption of worship. What you probably don't know, you may know, maybe some of you know, but most of you probably don't know, and I hinted last night, is that early Christian worship was very much like the worship that we reinstituted in places like Geneva and Heidelberg and Edinburgh in the 16th and 17th centuries. So if you know what those services are like, then you're very close to what was happening in the second century. This is just that you can do what you want with this, but it is a historical fact that there were no musical instruments in apostolic worship because there were no instruments in the synagogue. There's no instruments in the apostolic church. And the early second century fathers actually wrote actively against instruments. They wrote paragraphs in their works saying, we can't have that. That was all part of the Levitical typological system. That's all done. That's all fulfilled in Christ. Right? Now I know some of what they sang, but I'm still working on that. But that's a fact. There was no instrument in any Christian worship service until the 7th century. And even in the 13th century, Thomas Aquinas, great medieval theologian, said, we don't have instruments in our services. That would be Judaizing, meaning going back to the Old Testament, going back to the types and shadows, such that even the popes had no musical instruments in their services because it wasn't considered fitting for a papal mass. They were all conducted a cappella. So early Christian worship was very simple. It followed the synagogic pattern. There was the reading of the word. There was prayer. There was the singing of psalms. And it was all done a cappella. And again, we know that from the second century, what was taking place was the reading of the word. There was preaching, right? There was a message in the synagogue. There was a sermon in early Christian worship. There was prayer. There were only two sacraments, baptism and the Lord's Supper. And again, it was a cappella. But by the time you get to the fourth century, and what happened in the fourth century? Pardon?
Praise bands.
No, actually no praise bands. Not till the 7th century. There was a Spanish organ, right? So an organ is just a praise band in a box. So if we want to criticize I was making fun of the drum kits, but it's all in the organ. It's just, have you ever looked at an organ? Any organist here? You must have an organist, right? Those things are complicated. It's just a band in a box is all of this. At any rate, by the 4th century, lots of things are happening, but in worship and in the conduct of life in the church. Ministers are no longer talking about themselves as ministers. They're beginning to talk about themselves in other categories. The people called themselves or were called bishops prior to the 4th century, but mainly that just meant senior pastors. There are no actual regional managers, very few of them. By the time you get to Cyprian in 250, you're beginning to get to the regional manager. But he's still an active minister. He's not just a regional manager. In the second century, these are just senior pastors. Middle of the third century begins to become also a regional manager. By the fourth century and fifth century, you're moving in a more strongly hierarchical form of government. Right? As I said last night, there's no evidence of any papacy in the second century, third century, fourth, fifth, sixth. You're not looking at anything like a papacy until the seventh century. And even then, as I say, Gregory the Great was quite opposed to what we would later try to make him into be. And so ministers and bishops begin to dress, particularly bishops begin to dress like the civil officials. They begin to imitate the civil officials. And why? Well, we were made by Constantine a legal religion, which was a good thing because our property then was returned to us. They used to steal our property. They used to arrest us. They used to kill us. They used to interrogate us. They used to throw us to the lions. They used to cover us with pitch and set us on fire. So being a legal religion was a good thing. Becoming a state religion was problematic. Now, it didn't happen right away, but over time, we became the state religion. As we became the state religion, we, in effect, became an arm of the state. And that's always corrupting. For the church to be an arm of the state is always corrupting. You cannot show me any place ever in the history of the world or the church where being an arm of the state hasn't corrupted the church. It just has. That is why, wonderfully, in the United States, we set it up so that the church was not an arm of the state. It was much to our benefit. There's a reason why the church in this country, as bad as it is in some ways so much healthier than the church in Europe. Now, not as healthy as the churches in Africa. If you want to see serious Reformed Christianity, go to Nigeria. You know there are 1 million Reformed Christians in Nigeria? That's what I'm told, anyway. There's a huge number in the Congo. From the radio, just hearing it on the radio. People are showing up in villages and they see Église Réformée Confessant. The Reformed Confessing Church, a wooden sign painted by hand. Right? Because they heard the gospel on the radio. And it's a phenomenal, China, Korea, so whatever's happening here, it is actually happening in other parts of the world. Good things are happening, so don't be too discouraged, because you can get that way looking at the United States. And what happened gradually through the Middle Ages was that the church reinstituted the medieval system of worship, and they turned the king into David. So they reconstituted national Israel, and they reconstituted the Israelite pattern of worship. We go from having ministers of the word announcing the one finished sacrifice of Christ to priests offering daily sacrifices. It's like the book of Hebrews was never in the Bible. You want to defeat Romanism? Read the book of Hebrews. You just go through the book of Hebrews. It dismantles Romanism. Right? We don't need any more sacrifices. Once for all. The word, the phrase, once for all. It's in the Bible. It's in the book of Hebrews repeatedly. But we lost track of that, and we reinstituted the Israelite worship. We reinstituted sacrificial worship, and we began to imitate Old Testament worship. And that increasingly became the norm. Calvin called what happened. He had a word for it. He translates a word from Colossians 2:23. As will worship. This is really what happened. We had a spiritual crisis fostered in part by a lack of assurance, fostered in part by will worship. He says in his critique of will worship that there were two great needs in the 16th century, the recovery of divinely ordained worship, and the gospel of free acceptance with God. The due worship of God, says, its chief foundation is to acknowledge Him to be as He is, the only source of virtue, justice, holiness, wisdom, truth, power, goodness, mercy, life, and salvation. In accordance with this, to ascribe and render to Him the glory of all that is good, to seek all things in Him alone, and in every want, every lack, have recourse to Him alone. Hence arises prayer. Hence arises praise and thanksgiving, these being attestations to the glory which we attribute to Him. Moreover, the rule which distinguishes between pure and vitiated worship and of universal application, in order that we may not adapt any device which seems fit to ourselves, but look to the injunction of Him who alone is entitled to prescribe. This is the difference between the creator and creatures. Creator and creatures. We're creatures, and God is the creator, and God has established the rule. And in the medieval church, we lost track of that rule, and we instituted all, what Calvin called the whole form of worship, the whole form of divine worship in use today is nothing but mere corruption. God rejects, condemns, abominates all fictitious worship and employs His word as a bridle to keep us in unqualified obedience. We'll come back and in the next session I'll finish this up. But those are two of the great, there are other things that we could talk about, and we'll touch on this when we talk about how Luther became a Protestant and what it means. But the good news in the medieval church, the good news became bad news. We lost track of our doctrine of sin, and in the next session I'll talk about how that happened and what that meant. But we lost track of we lost track of the bad news. We lost track of what happened in the fall. And we downplayed the effect of what happened in the fall. And then we lost track of the good news. You must always have the bad news and the good news. If you don't get the bad news right, then the good news isn't as good. And if you don't get the good news right, then you're lost. And so we began to say to ourselves that, well, God has made salvation possible. And of course, this should sound familiar to you, right? If you were ever in an Arminian congregation, right? It's very similar to what I used to hear when I was in an Arminian evangelical congregation. God has made salvation possible. And he's waiting for you. If only you'll come. Softly and tenderly, Jesus is calling. And of course he is, but not in the way that I was led to think. That God was helpless and waiting and contingent upon me. And the truth is, and this is what we relearned in the Reformation, and we'll talk about this in the next session, that God has sovereignly reached into history, and by the power, right, of his grace and the power of Jesus Christ, and saved helpless sinners who could not save themselves. But by the time, leading up to the Reformation, we had really lost that sense. There were a few voices crying in the wilderness. There were some late medieval Augustinians who were saying, you know, what we've been saying is not right. We're really wickedly sinful and dead in sins and trespasses. They said that's in the Bible. They didn't quite have the answer, however, because they were still saying to themselves that God can only say of us righteous if we are actually righteous. So they set it up so that God is sovereignly making us righteous, which is, by the way, a popular scheme today. There are Reformed people who are teaching you this, want to teach you this, that God is sovereignly making you intrinsically righteous, and that's why God is calling you righteous. Which is a gross error, much to be rejected. Well, some of this will make more sense when we get to the next section. So we're going to take a break now. Is that my understanding? Yeah. And when do we come back?
10:30.
We come back at 10:30. Okay. So we'll take a break now, and we'll see you at 10:30.